99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today the numbers came out for May employment, unemployment, and they call it a mixed report. They were predicting that there would be 1 million jobs created. Well, they're not actually created, they're restored, you see. There's a difference between creating new jobs that didn't exist before, and in other words, the economy really expanding and creating new jobs. Businesses saying, well, you know, we got 200 workers, we need another 50. There's a difference between that and the businesses saying, well, we had 200, they were all laid off, let's call back 50. That's a qualitative difference, a reflection of the economy. We have a rebound going, no doubt, and a reopening, and employees are being called back, and that's reflected in the jobs report. But clearly, they're not being called back as fast as normally predicted. Again, the prediction was 1 million jobs, and only 559,000 only. Okay, now, you know, some of those are totally new jobs, people, young people, and others entering the labor market, maybe 100,000 a month. That's the new entrance into the labor market. And then the rest, you know, maybe 400 some thousand being recalled. But the recall was supposed to be much higher, supposed to be 1 million. And last month it was even worse. You know, I think there's like 260,000 recalled. Some portion of that is new, but it's very low. New job, you know, it's got to be certain industries that are really booming are actually adding new additional workers. Most of these are just recalled, but the recall is not as fast as they thought. Well, surprise, surprise, it never is when you have a deep contraction that we have going on. It takes longer. The deeper the contraction, the longer it takes to recall people back to work. You know, after 2008 and 2009, it took 5 to 6 years, I think. I think it was 6 years from 2008 to 2014-15 before we got back the total number of jobs we had in 2007 before the Great Recession. It took 6 years to get those jobs back. And it's not just that the deeper the recession, the longer it takes to recall the jobs. It's that there is a long-term trend going on in the U.S. economy. After every recession, it's taking longer to get the jobs back. You know, the early recessions in the post-war period, back in 1947-48, and then 53, and then 57-58, 61, a little bit in 69, 73-5, 81-2, right, 91, 2001, all of those, it was taking longer. There's a structural trend taking longer to restore the jobs. Now, back then, it was just a question of a few months or maybe a year, but it was getting longer and longer to get the jobs back. So there's a long-term structural trend in the U.S. capitalist economy to restoring jobs. Another thing you got to remember is that restoring jobs, the numbers are really irrelevant as far as the hours of work that people are being called back for. The trend is rising unemployment and temp workers. Every time there's a recession, business turns more to using part-time and temp as they come out of the recession. Part-time and temp are lower hours of work, fewer hours of work. So the job number, absolute number, may come back very slowly, right? More and more after each recession. Right? But the composition of the recalls are increasingly part-time and temp, which means fewer hours of work, lower weekly earnings. And that's been going on, you know, for a half century. So there's this underlying structural trend reflecting that. Longer recessions. And then when we hit the Great Recession of 2008, 8 to 10, actually we kept losing jobs while the GDP economy was recovering. We kept losing jobs. Right? It wasn't until after 2010 that they slowly reversed the loss and jobs slowly began to come back. More part-time and temp jobs once again. But it took us over five, maybe 6 years, I forget the exact number, 2015, I think it was, that we got back the same number of jobs that we had. So, you know, how many months is that? That's like 72 months, 60 to 70 months to get those jobs back, and they were back at lower pay. We lost, the jobs that were permanently lost were higher paid, and the jobs that were created were lower paid. So the average wage income, weekly income, adjusted for inflation, continued to decline during the Obama first term. Continued to decline. All right. So when this pandemic thing hit here early last year, you know, I had predicted that it's going to take years to get these jobs back. The jobs are not going to snap back. We have this phenomenon of a jobless recession, not GDP. GDP numbers are biased towards showing a recovery for various reasons. Maybe we'll do a show on that one time. But jobs are very concrete, right? You either got them or you don't got them. And after every recession, it's taking more months. Last one, 72 months. This one, no, we'll see, but I predict it's going to be going to take at least as long to bring those jobs back. A lot of the jobs are gone forever. You know, we've had millions of small businesses go under; they're gone. We have problems in supply chains now that the pandemic wrecked globally. Going to take some time to come back. We have other issues with people dropping out of the labor force and not coming back, and long-term duration of unemployment, right? or the median unemployment duration now longer and not clear how much that's recovering. So, you know, basically we have to sum up, we have this long-term trend. Every time there's a recession, jobs come back more slowly. The jobs that do come back tend to be fewer hours of work, therefore lower earnings, weekly earnings. This one's going to be no different. And clearly last 2 months, you know, they experts and economists predicted a million jobs. Well, they're not coming back by the millions, right? They're coming back slowly. And some of them are gone forever. Look, manufacturing last year was not affected that much by the pandemic. It kept going. So you're not going to see any big surge of jobs in manufacturing. And you're not going to see them in construction either, because construction, new construction, where you hire people, is coming back slowly because of supply chain and other problems of getting supplies for building homes. You're not going to see commercial property construction. You're not going to see them building a lot of new hotels, right? You're not going to see new office buildings. In fact, that's a crisis that's still coming. You know, people now working more remotely and will continue to work more remotely. They're not going to go into the big cities, into those office buildings the way they used to. And those office buildings are going to have problems with debt payment and defaults in future years. They got a lot big infusion of free money from the Fed and the government here, and that will tide them over, let them issue more junk bonds to tide them over a few more years. But the office space utilization in the big cities is not coming back to what it was, and eventually those properties will default. In other words, can't pay their principal and interest because they don't have as many many customers, not customers, but clients, whatever, occupying those big buildings. So construction, commercial property, forget it. You know, we're not going to see a lot there. You know, we're not going to see a lot of a sharp increase in home construction because of supply problems. We're not going to see a significant boost in manufacturing. And those are the high-paying jobs, by the way. You know, what's being recalled and coming back are the low-paying leisure and hospitality jobs. And I think, you know, businesses are being very cautious, and they're recalling a lot of people, yes, but at fewer hours of work. And that's why a lot of workers aren't taking it and jumping back. There's a lot of reasons why workers are not coming back. The job recalls are not that great, but those that are being recalled are at a lower pay. So, you know, is the problem the lower pay and the fewer hours of work, or is it the overgenerous unemployment benefits that McConnell Republicans and business media are really trumpeting here, right? They're saying, oh, workers are getting too much money. That's why they're not coming back. Well, you know, they may not be coming back because the employers aren't offering very, very much in terms of hours of work. That's a problem, I think. And then, of course, you have other problems why they're not coming back. They can't get child care. It's impossible to get child care. And what you can is, very, very expensive. You know, and they haven't really truly opened the schools. They're just beginning to do that now. Let's see if they're smart enough to require that in the fall. But in the meantime, people have to stay home and at least through May, early June here, and homeschool their kids remotely. Now, how many millions of those aren't coming back to work because they have to do that? You know, this hybrid thing, remote education, in many ways is a big flop, I think. And, you know, millions of kids, especially lower income kids, are getting no education whatsoever. None. Or very, very little. You know, a lot of them don't even have access to the internet. You know? And then their families, may be in manufacturing or in agriculture or whatever and working. They're not there to, you know, help educate their kids. It's the upper middle class that doesn't have to work, keeps a parent home that's able to do that, has all the best equipment, you know, to do remote learning. And you know, the remote learning thing under the best conditions is just a half a day, if that. So, you know, that's a big drag on people returning, lack of child care, affordable child care. And the subsidies on child care don't really start occurring until July, you see. That was one of the provisions of the COVID relief bill, the American Rescue Plan, to provide monthly, essentially a stipend for child care for families. But that doesn't really start until July, and it's only a limited time period. I think to the end of the year or maybe early next year, I'm not sure. That needs to be totally institutionalized, you know, if you really want people to return to work. So there's a lot of reasons why, you know, workers aren't coming back in a million a month. A part of it is on the employer side, responsibility on their side, not offering sufficient hours or even maybe lower rates of pay because they're cautious. They were burned. Businesses were burned badly by the COVID thing, opening and closing and opening and closing, you know. So they're not going to just call everybody back all at once, right? No. And they lost so much money last year, they're not going to call them back at full hours and full pay in many cases. And, you know, they'll test the market, see how many they can get back at a lower, fewer hours, lower pay, whatever. Now, in some cases, the service companies are desperate, and they're offering bonuses for them to come back. And workers are coming back in those cases, you know. But that's a small percentage of the total leisure and hospitality sector that employs huge amounts of workers in this country. Okay, so got to keep that in mind. And there's an interesting paper report that came out by San Francisco Federal Reserve that June 1st, this past week, that I think reflects what I'm saying here. The economists there have pretty much produced an analysis that shows the regular unemployment numbers that come out from the Labor Department today, as weak as they are, 559,000 jobs, as weak as they are, paint, to quote the San Francisco Federal Reserve paper called "The Divergent Signals About Labor Market Slack," quote, right, by Gilchrist and Hoban. And they conclude that, circumstances specific to COVID-19 have caused many indicators to paint an overly rosy picture of the labor market, unquote. Okay? Yeah. Quote, "The labor market situation is worse than some headline numbers suggest." Well, the headline numbers are not all that great, although, today's unemployment from the Labor Department rate went down to 5.8%. 5.8%. In other words, the San Francisco Fed paper is saying it's much worse than that headline number, 5.8. Well, I've been saying that a long time. In the paper, they look at 26 different indicators of what's called labor market slack. In other words, weakness in the labor market and in the hiring. Labor market slack, 26 of them. And they identify at least a half a dozen that are far worse than they were in previous recessions, including the Great Recession. We have a very high number of long-term unemployed. There was those out of work 27 weeks or more. We have a labor force participation rate that's chronically low, not moving very much, not budging. Labor force participation is the total number of people who could be in a labor force who are in a labor force, working or unemployed, actively looking for work. All right, that's the labor force. That's a percentage of the total that could be who actually are, and if they're unemployed, actively looking for work, last 4 weeks. That's the labor force participation rate. Well, it's it's close to just above 61%. Normally, it's like 64%. Normally, you've lost 3%. Now you may think, well, 3% is not very much. Well, 3% of 160 million workers, is about 5 million. 5 million that don't get counted. That 5 million dropping out of the labor force don't get counted in calculating the unemployment rate. They don't get calculated. Very important. Very important. So if you got an unofficial unemployment rate, 5.8%, and that's about 7 million workers, 7 to 8 million workers, then you add another 4 to 5 million. I think they estimate 3-point-something million dropped out of labor force. I think the number is higher. So let's say 4 million more. That puts the unemployment rate at well over 10%. Plus, if you simply look at number of people collecting benefits who are unemployed, obviously, right? Collecting benefits. You got about 15 million there. So 15 million plus another 4 or 5 million more dropped out of labor force. That's 20 million. 20 million people. Well, what is 20 million as a percentage of 160 million? Well, it's a labor force or unemployment, true unemployment rate around 15%. That's what we really have here, 15%, not 5.8%, because the 5.8% is only full-time workers unemployed, you see. That's called the U-3 unemployment rate, right? And that is, not really reflective of 50 million people who are part-time temp, how many millions more who are gig workers, how many millions more who dropped out. And, of course, the Labor Department has this error that they're continuing in their monthly survey. They ask people, are you out of work with expectation of return, i.e. furloughed because of the pandemic? Well, if you answered yes to that, they don't count you unemployed. You're jobless. You're not working, but you're not considered unemployed. And even Labor Department even said, well, that's probably an error, but they haven't changed it, you see. So you got all these other indicators, median duration of unemployment longer, job losers as a percent of unemployed, part-time for economic reasons, job leavers as a percent of unemployed, labor force participation rate, long-term unemployed. Those are all worse than they have been in previous recessions, and they aren't getting much better. They're all worse. And that's not picked up in the headline unemployment rate of 5.8% now. Again, the 5.8% is really 15%. And it's taking a longer time than they thought to bring people back. And it will continue to be, because every recession, it's been taking more months to get back to the level of unemployment, of employment before the recession. It's taking more months, right? Last time, Great Recession, it took 6 years, 72 months. I think the recession before that was like 48 months. And before that, 20-some months. So it's getting longer and longer to recall workers, because businesses, every time there's a recession, they figure out how to cut costs. They take that as an opportunity to cut costs. And part of the cost cutting is one, we don't need as many workers. You know, we're replacing them with new equipment, right? Or we're sending production offshore. We don't need as many workers as we had hired going forward. They say, well, let's hire people back more at a part-time or temp basis and test the market. Let's see, you know, if the business cycle really recovers, let's do it cautiously. So they bring people back more slowly, and they bring more of them back as part-time and temp. And that increases every time we have a business cycle and a recession, and it's no different now. It's going to take a long time to bring back those jobs. And as we know, many of them will never come back. A lot of businesses, small businesses, went out of business, will not come back, right? A lot of construction work is not going to come back. A lot of the manufacturing is not going to grow any further than it has. Unless, of course, we have a big infrastructure spending bill. Then it might, you know, create a lot of jobs and alternative energy and so forth, then it might. And if you do something about the tax incentives to move offshore, move manufacturing offshore, which exists, or move businesses offshore, not just manufacturing, you know, the tax system really rewards offshoring of jobs. That's got to fundamentally change. And of course, so does free trade. What is free trade? You know, in part, it's about eliminating tariffs for imports coming into the country. Eliminating tariffs. Well, you know, if I'm a U.S. multinational corporation, I get a tax incentive to invest, and I decide to invest and expand offshore rather than onshore in the U.S., right? Then I can produce more goods offshore, and I can bring them back to the U.S. and sell them here without paying a tariff. That's why most of the auto parts manufacturing has moved to Mexico and other places, you see, just across the border. U.S. auto companies don't manufacture autos. They just assemble the parts. A lot of the manufacturing of those parts are made offshore, whether it's engines or whatever it is. Yeah, and then it's brought across the U.S. border without paying a tax for imports called a tariff. You see, that's what free trade is. It's like a double whammy. You know, you move taxes, tax incentives move the jobs offshore, and then free trade allows the stuff being produced offshore to come back to the U.S. at a lower cost to the business. They go hand in hand. And the result, of course, is a loss of high-paying jobs. And that's been going on for decades now, and still is. A lot of that going to China. So, you know, that's a big problem, and that's what companies do. They figure out, you know, in the depths of the recession, well, we're going to come out of this at some point. Let's get lean and mean. We don't need to bring as many people back. It's cheaper to expand an offshore subsidiary and bring it back because of free trade. Let's bring people back more part-time and temp. You know, you got a huge number of temp workers in manufacturing now. And, of course, they make less. They make less, and they're easy to hire and fire. Business wants to be very flexible. They want to be able to get rid of people and bring people back and get rid of them without much interference. Well, when you got temp and part-time workers, you can do that. The temps, you know, you can fire them and hire them real quick, right? And agencies do the work for you. And the part-timers, you can increase or decrease their hours real quick. And so businesses are using those measures more and more, especially every time we have a recession. And the consequence is jobs come back more as part-time temp and at lower pay and fewer hours than we had before the recession. So long-term trend, been going on for decades, right? Going on for decades. And it's no different now. And it seems to me that the deeper the initial contraction, like 2008-09, and of course 2020 here with COVID, the deeper it is, the more exacerbated these long-term trends really are. So bottom line, don't expect jobs to be recalled very quickly, and we're seeing that clearly now. Jobs will rebound, no doubt, you know. But until we do something about the labor force participation rate, until we do something about, you know, not making all these incentives to move offshore or incentives, right, to bring people part-time and temp back to work, until we do something about that, you know, we're going to have a problem here in the labor markets. Yeah, well, we could spend all day talking about the labor markets, but that's my take. Also, you know, the yesterday, one more comment here. Yesterday, the new claims for unemployment benefits, right, went down to like 385,000 weekly new claims. Again, that was just for the state program, not the overlaid federal program for free freelancers and self-employed and so forth. That's called the PUA, Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. That number is probably around, well, it was around 100,000 on top of the 385, so about 500,000 every week filing for new unemployment benefits, which is also a better indicator of the true state of the labor market. But even that indicator is getting weaker now, I think, because you got 30 states who are dropping people unilaterally and prematurely off of the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. They're just saying, we're not offering it anymore. Right? Most of the red states, Republican states, right? Legislature and governor states. Just arbitrarily, I mean, under the COVID relief bill passed, that was supposed to not begin to occur until September. Well, they're doing it prematurely, you know, using the excuse that, oh, they're overpaid, that's why they're not coming back to work. Yeah, it's, you know, Tennessee, places like that. So, you know, that kind of reduces the accuracy of the PUA claims, new claims. It's going to reduce those claims, obviously. If the program's not there, you're not going to file for it if you're a freelancer and jobless. So that number is going to come down as well. But is it because people are getting jobs? No. They're going to be more in the ranks of labor force dropouts, probably. Okay, enough said on the job picture here. Let's move to the infrastructure. Yeah, we've been talking about the infrastructure bill quite a bit, but it's worth discussing, and some real interesting developments this past week have occurred with regard to the infrastructure bill negotiations, sometimes called American Jobs Act, okay, infrastructure bill. If you remember, it started out being proposed $2.25 trillion by Biden, right? He passed a $1.8 trillion COVID relief bill. That was designed to put money quickly into the hands of households to help fill the, you know, the big hole created by all that joblessness last year. And small businesses, by the way. Small businesses got roughly $1 trillion here over the past year. It was $2.25 trillion. Infrastructure is supposed to really create jobs intermediate and long term. The COVID relief bill was really throw money into households to fill the gap and get them spending again. So it was a short term, very short term mitigation bill, three, four months. That's all these kind of bills really have an economic effect. And that was to be supplemented now by a longer term job creation investment infrastructure bill, right? So short term, buy some time, longer term infrastructure. And that's what's being negotiated now. Coming down the track here is a third bill called American Families Plan, which is really designed to boost incomes for families, consumer households, longer term, right? So short term, intermediate, longer term infrastructure bill and longer term income bill. That's the three go together. And then there's tax proposals. How do you pay for it all, right? Well, what happened this past week is that Biden did an about face, 180 degree shift, cut unilaterally, arbitrarily, cut another $700 billion out of his infrastructure proposal. He had previously cut $550 billion unilaterally without any real concessions by Republicans. So you go from $2.25 trillion to $1.7 trillion. You know, that was about a week ago, unilaterally, he cut. And then you go from within days, you go from 1.7 trillion to 1 trillion. So, you know, in a matter of, you know, week, 10 days, he's cut well over half of his proposal. Well over half. From 2.25 trillion, he's down to 1 trillion, which I predicted. Just go read my tweets on my Twitter account, you know, where I'm talking about these moves day to day at Dr. Jack Rasmus, and you can follow, you know, the thread of my commentary there and predictions. And I predicted he'd come down to 1 trillion. You know, when he first cut to 1.7, I said, now he's going to come down to 1 trillion. Watch it. All right. The Republicans, for their part, initially proposed $568 billion. Initially. Except almost $400 billion of that was money already authorized to be spent by Congress. Already authorized. So nothing new. You know, they're just moving the money from one category into another category and saying, oh, this is part of our proposal. No, it's already been authorized in another proposal. Authorized to be spent. And when Biden went down from 2.25 to 1.7 trillion, the Republicans went up to 928 billion. But 350 billion of that was moving the money from the previously unspent monies authorized in the COVID relief bill passed here in March, 1.8 trillion. 350 billion of that was earmarked to go to state and local governments. So the Republicans are saying, well, let's move that into our proposal for the infrastructure. In other words, take it away from the states, right? They haven't spent it yet, and put it in our proposal for infrastructure spending, right? Moving the money around. So, you know, except for maybe $100 billion or so, the Republicans are just moving the money around. Those aren't net new. Those aren't net new spending. That's already been authorized to spend. They're just claiming money here and there and saying, oh, this is our proposal. Yeah, very clever, but, you know, pretty obvious of what they're doing. And that's how they get the $928 billion, right? Well, Biden's cutting real money out of, you know, real new proposed spending. He's cutting real money. They're just moving money around. Right? But then you got this thing going on in the Democrat ranks. Joe Manchin, Blue Dog Democrat, right? Joe Manchin wants to play the same Republican game within the Democratic Party. He wants to use $304 billion that's already been authorized to be spent in the transportation bill, highway bill, and to move that into Biden's proposal. Now, it's not clear to me. Maybe Biden, in cutting from $1.7 trillion to $1 trillion, is doing that. You see, we don't have a lot of details, you know, of what's going on here in terms of the composition of these cuts. We just have the numbers being cut, right? And then they'll fill the pot with the composition. You know, it's just negotiation on the bottom line number that's going on. So, you know, Biden's officially now at $1 trillion. And the Republicans are $928 billion. And the only question is not the final number, which will be, you know, $1 trillion or less. The final, the only question is what does that entail? What's the composition of that $1 trillion, you know, in the infrastructure bill? Well, you know, if you look at the bill itself, the initial bill, get your pencil out if you want these numbers. $621 billion was to go for transportation spending. $174 billion of that was a subsidy to the U.S. car companies to accelerate their R&D and development and manufacturing of electric vehicles, including the government would spend, I don't know how much that $174 billion, to build out for the auto companies 500,000 electric charging stations in the country. So, you know, $621 billion, $174 billion of that is direct subsidies. Yeah, of infrastructure by the government, electric, auto companies, right? Now, $590 billion more of that 2.25 original infrastructure proposal was for manufacturing, research and development, and job retraining. Another $590 billion of that, okay? Well, some of that's undoubtedly going to be cut, and maybe it has been in Biden's reductions here, right? Is that infrastructure, subsidizing manufacturing and R&D? Is that infrastructure? Not really. It's a big subsidy proposal. You know, the $621 billion for transport, transportation spending, okay, but is $174 billion subsidy to the auto companies for electric cars, is that infrastructure? No, you see, this is a big pie of subsidies for American corporations, a lot of this. You know, at least over $1 trillion is really subsidies to American companies, you know, not really infrastructure. Okay, what's likely to be cut out of that, or maybe it's already being cut, right? $40 billion of that $590 billion is allocated for worker dislocation expenses and retraining. Well, they'll cut that, right? $12 billion for worker development in the low-income communities. Well, they'll cut that. $10 billion for safety and health, workforce protections. They'll cut that. You know, so there's at least 70 to 100 billion out of that 590, which is not infrastructure, that, you know, I predict Biden will cut. Right? What he's really going to whack, though, is another $400 billion for home care services and home care workers. $400 billion in the infrastructure bill, right, to really develop services and provide for jump-starting employment and raising wages for home health care workers. $400 billion. Well, the Republicans really don't want that. And I predict, if he hasn't already, Biden will drop that $400 billion and say, oh, well, you know, it's kind of what we're thinking about in the family leave plan that's coming down the road after the infrastructure bill. He'll say, well, we'll deal with it in this other bill that's coming. And he'll take that out if he hasn't already. We don't know. Okay, and then there's $400 billion more for clean energy tax credits. Well, I think as far as consumer tax credits for clean energy, you know, part of that $400 billion Republicans don't want, and I think Biden will concede on that. You know, getting back to the home health care services for elderly and disabled, the $400 billion, the proposal is for most of that to be spent through Medicaid. And, oh, the Republicans hate Medicaid spending. Yeah, that's actually giving money to people who are poor and who really need it. They won't agree to that. And in the spirit of bipartisanship, I think Biden will drop that as well. So there'll be money hacked out of that and out of the clean energy tax credits for households. Right? There'll be some money hacked out of the manufacturing R&D proposal for as far as you know, job retraining and job protections. Another $328 billion is really for buildings. Well, you could say that's infrastructure, buildings, right? Yeah. $126 billion for creating energy-efficient housing units, in other words, upgrading a lot of housing so it uses alternative energy, right? $50 billion for schools, $40 billion for public housing, $25 billion for child care facilities, $18 billion for upgrading VA hospitals, $20 billion for low-income homes, community colleges, etc. Well, some of that has already been provided in the COVID relief bill, you know, like for schools, although that was really more money for schools to reopen and to make sure everybody gets vaccinated and protected going forward. This is really money for upgrading the facilities of the schools themselves. So I could see the Republicans agreeing to some of that, but certainly it's not going to be $328 billion. And then there's $311 billion for broadband, you know, the power grid and clean water. You know, $100 billion for broadband, $100 billion for power infrastructure, $56 billion for drinking water supplies, $45 billion for removing lead in drinking systems, which is widespread across the country, and another $10 billion for rural water systems, right? Well, the Republicans will agree to some of that, but, you know, not all of that. And that's infrastructure, okay? So the broadband, the power grid, clean water, that's infrastructure. So buildings, schools, VA hospitals, child care facilities, federal buildings upgrades, that's infrastructure. You could argue clean energy tax credits if it's for infrastructure. That qualifies. The home services, Republicans will not agree to that. And I think that $400 billion will be pulled out if it hasn't been already in the reduction to $1 trillion. Some of the worker-related $590 billion for manufacturing R&D will be pulled out. And some of the $620 billion for transportation will be pulled out. So we're going to see a lot of this occurring in the negotiations in the next few weeks. We're down to $1 trillion. The only question is, That's the final number, I think. The only question is, what's the composition of the spending in that, right? It won't be home health care services. It'll be a weak clean energy tax credits. It's not clear to me whether this manufacturing R&D stuff has been pulled out as a separate track. It looks like they're negotiating a separate track for that because Republicans like that. Right, so that might be pulled out on a separate track. I don't know. Details are not very clear in many cases here. Now, what about paying for it? What about paying for it? Well, this is very interesting. Right. Just as Biden announced a further unilateral reduction in his total infrastructure spending proposal to $1 trillion this past week, the week before he went from 2.25 to 1.7, now he's gone to 1. Just as he's done that, he's reduced his tax hikes to pay for it. Big time. Remember, Trump cut taxes, the corporate tax rate, from 35% to 21%. Biden ran for office saying he'd raise it to 28, halfway. All right. Then he started giving signals, well, 25% maybe. This past week, just a couple of days ago, he said it would be 15%. So he's cutting taxes. He's cutting taxes just like Trump cut. He's following Trump's lead. Instead of raising from 21 to 28, he's saying he's lowered from 21 to 15. Now, his argument is, well, 15, everyone's got to pay that minimum tax. All these corporations have to pay minimum because many of them don't pay anything, you see. They don't pay anything. So he says, okay, it's going to be 15% minimum. And, of course, we're going to raise some revenue by making those corporations that pay nothing pay at least 15%. Well, how much? Well, estimates are in his proposal that 15% minimum tax on book income, by the way. You don't book it, you don't pay it, right? But, okay, we won't discuss that one. We'll raise $100 billion over 10 years. Raise $100 billion in taxes. Tax revenue by saying 15% minimum. So it does raise it a little bit. But by reducing the corporate tax rate in general to 15% from 21, right, or 28, he proposed 28%, remember? That would have brought $850 billion in tax revenue to the government to help pay for these programs. $850 billion. That's gone, right? It's 15%. 15% brings in $100 billion. Eliminating the 28% reduces it by $850 billion. So there's a tax revenue cut here of $750 billion. Well, isn't that about the amount he said that he would spend less? From 1.7 trillion to 1 trillion? Yeah. If you cut it, you cut your tax revenue out by 700 billion plus, you're going to have to reduce your spending by about the same amount, 700 billion, which he did. So this is really a momentous week here as far as these negotiations are concerned. He reduced his tax hit on corporations by $750 billion, and he reduced his spending proposals by roughly the same amount, $700 billion. All that remains is how much of it will be smoke and mirrors here on the Democrat side. We know the Republican 928 is smoke and mirrors, right? Moving $350 billion from the COVID Act and some billion from already authorized funds to constitute the 928, right? How much of Biden's $1 trillion is also smoke and mirrors? Well, you know, there's Joe Manchin out there wants to move $304 billion of already authorized spending into the Biden bill. Well, if he does that, you know, there's really only about $700 billion actual spending. It's not enough. It's not enough to generate a sustained recovery. Because workers, as we said in the first half of the show, are coming back slowly. Their wages and hours of work are lower as they come back. And you're not going to see any more high-wage growth in jobs in manufacturing, construction, because of problems there. Or the fact that, you know, there's not much to recall. They've been working. It's all service jobs, so the income's not coming back here very quickly. And what will that mean? Will this just be another rebound like we had last summer, dissipate by the end of the year? Well, it could very well if the infrastructure bill turns out to be pretty weak and it's moving in the wrong direction. You know? A trillion long-term. That's a trillion long-term over 10 years. So we're really looking at, you know, maybe $100 billion in infrastructure spending. That's all for this first year, in this first budget year, 2021. Only $100 billion. That's not going to boost much, if anything. No. So, I'm not too optimistic that this rebound from the reopening, which is occurring, you know, is going to generate enough household income to turn the rebound into a sustained recovery lasting more months. Looks to me like it could very well dissipate once again. Very well. You know, we got a mitigation bill in the COVID relief American Rescue Plan, just like we got with the CARES Act a year ago, that bought 3 to 4 months of boosting the economy moderately. And we had a rebound overlaid, partial reopening overlaid on that last summer. Okay, and we got 7.5% recovery in the GDP numbers in the third quarter. And that all but disappeared in the fourth quarter. You know, from 7.5% GDP growth, we fell to 1.1% in the fourth quarter GDP growth. That's nothing. That was the economy flattened out once again, right? And then we boosted some income, $800 and some billion in the unemployment benefits and $600 checks at the end of last year. That bought us another couple months. Now we got the American Rescue Plan, more checks, unemployment benefits supposed to be through September, but now mostly not in 30 states. You know, that will buy us some months here into the summer. Overlaid once again with a rebound due to reopening the economy. But if people aren't being brought back at decent jobs and weekly incomes in large numbers, if the labor market is really weaker, as the Federal Reserve San Francisco says, right, those jobs and income, wage income, is not going to come back in sufficient magnitude to really turn the summer rebound into a sustained recovery. Difference between rebound and sustained recoveries. I don't see the income there, particularly with the situation with wages and job recalls, and the situation with the infrastructure bill, which is supposed to take up where the COVID relief leaves off, dissipates after 3-4 months, supposed to take off, you know, take up that slack and keep the government stimulus going. You know, $100 billion, you know, over the course of this year is not enough. Government fiscal stimulus, it's not enough. Now, you know, Biden doesn't have to go through all this bipartisan bullshit. He doesn't have to. He can pass the budget reconciliation bill. and do it all just the Democrats. Tell Republicans to go to hell and do it. Except he's got a big problem, and that's Joe Manchin and, you know, his partner there, Sisema from Arizona, who are acting more like shills for Mitch McConnell in the Democratic Party. Yeah. I mean, Biden's negotiating with whom? Capito. Her name is Capito. She's the other West Virginia senator, Republican. And he's backing up. Well, you know, I'm sure Capito is working very closely with Manchin. Coordinated. Manchin's the inside connection, and Capito's their outside Republican. They're both multimillionaires, both of them. And Manchin's Republican, Democrat name only. Policies are Republican, no doubt. So that's the problem Biden has. You know, he's got two fake Democrats there who are really working with Mitch McConnell. So he kind of knows, I think, that he couldn't get the budget reconciliation deal done anyway. It's a big problem. Democrats have. It just shows you, the composition of the Democratic Party is such that you can't get the reforms you really need. So there's not enough money to pay for it. You know, he's already backtracked on the corporate tax. And by the way, $500 billion, I predict he'll backtrack on another provision in his tax proposals, which is to raise $500 billion on U.S. multinational corporations offshore. It's called the GILTI tax. It's a nice acronym. G-I-L-T-I, the GILTI tax. You know, in his initial tax proposals, raise $500 billion there by taxing offshore corporations more, ending this big tax loophole called inversions, taxing fossil fuels, right? And what's called foreign intangible income. There's no kind of ways that offshore U.S. businesses really get away with paying virtually nothing in many cases. Yeah. So, you know, there's trillions of dollars offshore that Trump gave them. In additional tax cuts, you know, the big beneficiaries of the Trump tax cuts, $2 trillion, were the U.S. multinational corporations. You know, their 35% rate was dropped to 10.5%, and that's reduced by how much taxes they pay to their foreign governments. So, you know, they move offshore, you maybe pay 3, 4, 5% tax rate that you don't have to pay Uncle Sam. Big incentive to move offshore, which still exists. Okay, well, that's the picture, you know, latest fiscal negotiation follies going on here. Smoke and mirrors, and retreat by the Democrats. Surprise, surprise. I'm out of here.